And Selby, and Selby Reel 2. So you decided on the Gulf, Anne. What did you know when the decision, you know, this choice was put to you about the crisis? Did you understand the sort of politics and the sort of dangers?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I've never been one to ignore the news, and I've always had an interest in current events. And of course, it was something that was widely discussed in the sergeant's mess. And certainly, as the crisis sort of accumulated, it was discussed almost every day. So, you know, there was not much about it that you didn't know from the papers, from people who had actually gone there and come back in sort of they'd gone there in reconnoitring roles, and they'd actually come back and told us little bits and pieces. And of course, the one aspect that wasn't widely talked about, although we were all aware of it, was the possibility of chemical warfare, you know, and that actually didn't really sort of start to hit home, I think, until the day that my friend and I were given the kind of choice. She was given the choice, well, we were given the choice of Wilton and the Gulf, and I went to the Gulf, she went to Wilton. And we always laughed because she didn't like wearing combat trousers. She preferred to wear a skirt and her high heels. And we always kind of laughed about that. You know, and it was like a standing joke between us. And then, of course, I was told that obviously I had to report for certain things. But prior to that, I got almost like a bird's eye view of what preparations were being made, because Mal and I all of a sudden were sent to Bicester. No, Donington, sorry, it was Donington, I do beg your pardon. It was COD Donington, Central Women's Depot Donington, up near Telford, up near where Mal actually comes from, in order to help them log the database for the supplies that were being sent from Donington. And we sat in front of computers in this huge warehouse, and there was literally a list of everything that was being sent out, and you could tell from the items that were being sent just exactly what they thought was going to happen. You know, the NBC suits, the respirators, you know, the anti-decontamination kits, DKP as we used to call them. All of that stuff was being sent out, in amongst obviously the usual things that you prepare for war with. And that kind of gave us an idea. It was while I was at Donington that I actually had the first vaccination. I actually had I think it was the cholera vaccination that I had there. And then the plan was that I would finish there, we would do that for 2 weeks, and then we would finish there, we'd both come back, Mal would then go to UKNF, and I would be then kitted out at the depot, which was where I was anyway, and trained at the depot for preparation for going to the Gulf. And my task was to be admin support to the laundry platoons, who were, interestingly enough, Territorial Army. And they actually had to special enlist everybody in order to send them over there, because at the time, no Queen's Order had been given to mobilise the Territorial Army. The only Queen's Order that had been given was to mobilise the reserves. So to send TA out there would have been an illegal act. So they got round it by enlisting everybody on what they call a special enlistment, like a one-year enlistment. So basically, although the units were TA, they were all regular. They were regular for a year, they became regular soldiers. So I was sent out there as admin support, and of course one of the requirements to be this was that I also had to be trained as a laundry operator. So I was told that we would have the 2 weeks of laundry op training, with the Territorial Army instructors, who were brilliant. I mean, I knew them all as it happened, because they all came from the original HQ, and I knew them all, and they were really good, damn good at their job, really good. And they trained us in, you know, how to operate the huge laundry machines, which actually were transported on flatbeds. But you had to know everything about water pressure, and because obviously you didn't always, you weren't always going to be in a place where they had a tap. So you had to find your water source. It could have been a lake, and you had to run lines, and so it was quite complicated. And then I had to go and do 3 weeks Gulf War training. And this is the point that I always make when people mention things like Gulf War illness. Because basically, you had to be fit. The Gulf War training was almost like a mini recruit training all over again. It was quite horrendous. It was extremely physical. It was 5 mile marches every morning, carrying the long poles. I don't know if you've ever seen that, where the soldiers run with the long poles in training. Up through all sorts of terrain. We had to do intensive NBC training, which is first aid and defence and nuclear, chemical and biological warfare. With the gas masks, you have to be fully au fait with everything, because as they pointed out, it was literally mask in 6 seconds or you're dead. You know, so you had to learn how to kit up very quickly. And all of the things that had been a joke to us before, that everybody had joked about prior, and right down through the years that I'd been in the army, everybody made little jokes like, oh, you know, take your gas mask off, oh, really? Yes, you are taking it off, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, everybody would, like, go into the gas chamber and have the CS gas, and you'd be made to take your respirator out and off, and then run out the door, and your eyes would be streaming. And all of a sudden, it wasn't a joke anymore. And the little jokes about the buddy-buddy things, about you having to take a buddy to the toilet and help you, all of a sudden, that was not a joke. This was like deadly earnest. And you knew your life depended on this. Because if even just a pinhead of this nerve agent touched your skin, you were going to die. So you had to be good at it. And by the time they finished with us, we were good at it. But we constantly got beasted throughout the whole thing by the instructors to say, you know, oh, you're terrible, you're not going to survive 2 minutes. And then one little private, I remember, piped up from the background, a little TA girl that had been boarding as regular, suddenly piped up from the background, well, we're so terrible and you're so good, how come is it that they're going? And so, basically, the training was horrific. And if you had not been fit, and bear in mind, by this time, I am 39 years old. I'm something like 3 months, 4 months away from my 40th birthday. And you have to be fit. They made us do a BFT, and of course it was kept according to strict regulations, the basic fitness test, 2 mile run, timed. And of course the laugh was generally that when you got to my age, the age of 39, you were practically given, you know, half an hour of packed lunch and sleeping bag. But people between the ages of 18 and I think something like 25 had to do it in 11 minutes. So I had quite a long time to do it. And of course it was done in kit. It was done in your army kit. The only thing that they normally allowed you to wear was your trainers. But in actual fact, I did it in boots. So you had your boots to contend with. Obviously, you didn't have any headgear, you didn't have a weapon, you didn't have a pack, but you weren't dressed in shorts and a t-shirt, put it that way. You were dressed in combats and boots, and you went around, you did this. And just a little joke, I mean, a humorous part of it, I actually was coming up to the last stage, and I could see everybody waiting, and there was this particular PTI, and his name was Sergeant Smith. And he was standing there, and he saw me coming up, and of course I'm trudging along, puffing, you know, running along, puffing and panting. And I hear him say, "Come on, Staff, come on, you've got 20 seconds to get up here." And I think I had something like 100 yards to run. And I thought, my immediate thought was, "Oh my God, no, I'm just going to die before I get there." And I literally, I don't know where it came from, but I put on this spurt and I tore up and I tore past him. And when he came up to me, I could not breathe. I was literally put so much into it. I couldn't breathe. I just couldn't get my breath at all. And he just looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Oh, well done, Staff." He said, "You just did that in 10 minutes and 10.5 minutes." I said, "I'm going to kill you." I said, "Do you realise I just nearly killed myself doing that bit?" He said, "I wanted to be the first one to get a 39-year-old through in under 11 minutes. And by the time I got back to the camp, nearly all the camp had heard about it. All these people were saying, well done, well done." But and that was what makes me so angry when it comes to the Gulf War thing, because people are saying things like, "Well, there can't be anything wrong, because, you know, nothing could have happened to you, because, you know, there must be something that was there before." If it was something there before, they would have found it. Because after you did that training, they made you go through a Pullens, which is a full medical. And they test everything. And I passed the medical. So my contention is, if there'd been anything wrong with me, the army would have found it long before then. Then we were sent for our vaccinations. And we were sent to Cambridge Military Hospital in Aldershot, which of course is now no longer in existence, for this. And none of us were told, none of us were briefed as to what we were going to be vaccinated against. We were just told that we had to report for shots. And I'd already had the cholera. And when we got there, we were literally on a conveyor belt, practically. They just made us stand in a long line, and you walk through this room, and they stabbed you in the arm with this stuff. And it wasn't really until we got to the other end that we actually said, "Well, you know what? What is half of this stuff that you've given us?"
How many stabs did they give you?
Counting the cholera, I had 10 injections, vaccinations in all, and I had 9 of them in 1 hour in one day. And amongst the 9, you're talking hepatitis A and B, meningitis, anthrax, pertussis, polio, yellow fever, tetanus, typhoid. And then when we got out to theatre, we were actually given a second anthrax and a plague vaccine. And there was also another vaccine which has been classified as secret, which they have not told anybody what it is. But we can form a hypothesis. It possibly was botulism, we don't know. But these are all, in actual fact, a lot of them were unregistered, unlicensed. For use in this country. Certainly the plague vaccine was. I know for a fact that was only licensed in this country August to September 1991, which was long after we had all come back. And they gave that one to us out in theatre. We also know that they used pertussis as an adjuvant, which is something that makes the vaccine work faster. And I believe that it was, I believe it was the vaccine, anthrax, that was meant to work faster, because anthrax itself is given in so many doses over a very long period of time in order to be effective. Well, there was no way that two anthrax vaccinations were going to be effective for us. And at the same time, of course, we were looking at each other and thinking, well, why anthrax? Why are they giving us anthrax, you know? And of course, we didn't dawn on us till a long time after we returned, or dawn on me a long time after we returned. 1993, in fact, before I realised, and before I had done research myself and realised that the governments knew what Saddam Hussein had in his arsenal, for the basic fact is that they sold it to him. So they knew. So what they had done was they had decided that they were going to throw everything at us so that we would be blanket protected. And I also believe that in a way they did what they thought was right. I don't argue specifically with that. And I was a soldier, they gave me an order, I obeyed the order, that's what I was there to do. But I think also they relied upon that order, or they relied upon the knowledge that the soldiers were well disciplined and would obey orders. But in actual fact, what they did was not legal, because you're not supposed to give somebody something and not tell them what it is. And that's exactly what they did. They gave us stuff and didn't tell us what it is. They just said, you will have injections. You know, and so therefore, you know, there's such a thing as informed consent.
So was there any opportunity at all for you to be sort of informed of this beforehand and to ask if you could sign, you know, whether or not you would have these injections?
We knew at the beginning of the Gulf War training that we would have to go and have these injections. We just didn't know when it would happen. But we were told we would have to have certain vaccinations. And I think that during that 3 weeks of the Gulf War training, they had ample opportunity to brief us. They could have sent somebody down from Cambridge military, you know, an officer, to just sit and brief us and say, okay, this is what they're going to give you. You know, and this is why we're giving it to you. You know, we want you to be protected. And then left it up to the soldier to have the choice of being protected or perhaps not protected. But, you know, I mean, I think most of us still probably would have done it. But I think that the main problem with that, with the whole thing, was that it's not so much that they actually gave us the vaccinations, in that they didn't warn us, and then afterwards, when we all came back and all of a sudden we're getting ill, they're then turning around saying, no, it can't be anything possibly wrong with you. And at the time, we were all we were saying to them was, look, something's wrong. And all we wanted them to do was to say, yes, we agree, something's wrong. Let's find out what it is and we make it right. Instead, they went down that big river in Egypt, you know, denial. You know, and they were, no, nothing. You know, there's nothing wrong. Nothing wrong with you. Go away. You know, you're talking a load of rubbish. And yet people all of a sudden are, you know, not able to breathe, and they're getting these horrific rashes, and some people have severe, you know, like nervous system damage. And
yes, I must ask you a lot about the sort of symptoms. Mm-hmm. But while you were filing through this shed, am I right in saying you had 9 in that mm-hmm. period?
Yeah.
Was there anyone who, you know, did you think of querying
yes,
it? Or
I queried mm-hmm. it to one of the male nurses, or the medical military staff that was there. And I said, look, I said, if you have injections like this to go on a holiday, they generally leave, you know, 48 hours in between vaccinations. You know, are we going to have any kind of kickback from this? And I was told, oh, don't worry about it. You may feel a bit flu-y for a few days, but you'll be all right, don't worry. In actual fact, we did feel flu-y, but for more than a few days. In fact, most of us actually went back. We went on to the laundry training, and I remember feeling quite ill. Most of us had flu-like symptoms, and it lasted for a long time. And when I finally flew out in January, I had a very bad chest infection. I coughed, I went coughing my way through that flight out to Riyadh. And so, yes, we did have the opportunity. That's what I was told anyway. But the opportunity to refuse, no, we weren't given that. Anyway, that was the situation, basically, when we left. We were...
Were you given embarkation leave? You know, did you have any leave beforehand?
Yes. There was a problem, literally. As the approach to Christmas came, I had made arrangements with my ex-husband that I would go back to see the boys for what might have been the last time, for all I knew. And he said that he would go and stay with his mother and let me stay with the boys in the house and have them to myself. And the problem was that as the situation kept kind of changing, I don't know if you remember at the time, it was very, very changeable, and they kept changing our day's notice to move. Soldiers, once you're on orders for moving, you're given so many hours' notice, so many days' notice to move. And depending on the length of that is whether they are able to give you embarkation leave. And at first they were saying, oh yes, you can go over the Christmas. And then as we approached the Christmas, it was like something like the 23rd of December, we were being told, well, we don't think we'd be able to let you go. So I was busy saying to my ex-husband, look, I'm supposed to be coming on the 23rd, and then I was ringing up and saying I may not make it. And then I was saying, yes, I will make it. And this happened for something like the week before the Christmas period. Finally, I think we were finally given notice to move, literally on the 23rd. We were told that we could have the embarkation leave, but that we had to leave a contact telephone number in case we had to, you know, go very quickly and come back to camp. And that was the way it happened. And so when I got home, my husband had used this as an excuse not to go to his mother's. And of course he was there waiting for me. And he said, well, you'll have to sleep with me. And I said, no, I don't. I said, I'll sleep on the couch. He says, oh, no, really, you take the bed. And we tried to make it amicable, though. I mean, we didn't argue too much. I mean, by this time, of course, we are separated. And I'm in this house, which basically I'm paying for still. And I'm providing for everybody still. And I'm like a stranger in this house, which is really sort of meant to be mine. We did our best to try and make it a reasonable Christmas. We went out shopping on Christmas, and we bought presents, we bought a Christmas tree. And all the time I'm thinking, this may be the last one I ever see. This, you know, and by this time it is really hitting home to me. You know, I may not see my kids again. You know, I may not be alive this time, you know, next Christmas. And Christmas night, my ex-husband, who was still in a band, but working part-time in the band, had actually gone out on a gig. And I fell asleep on the Christmas night in the chair watching this film, and I woke up to find a commotion. And my son comes running up the stairs and he says, Mum, I think you better come down to the kitchen because my dad's got his antidepressants, because he'd gone on antidepressants after lasting for a divorce. And he's drinking and he's taken most of his antidepressants, and I think you need to do something about this. And I thought, oh, I just don't believe this. So I ran down the stairs, and he certainly was kind of losing it a bit. And I totally lost my temper. I did lose it. And I my husband's only about 5'6", so I grabbed hold of him by his shoulders and I was shaking him. And his head was just flopping backwards and forwards like it was hinged on his neck, you know. And I'm saying, I'll kill you, I'm going to kill you. How could you do this, you know? And he's laughing at me and saying, yeah, well, you know, go on, kill me, because then if you kill me, you know, you'll have to stay here then. You know, and then he's saying things like, you know, I'm old, and, you know, what am I supposed to do now, and no other woman's going to want me and everything, and he was going on like this. And of course, obviously, it was that he wasn't functioning correctly because of the antidepressants he'd taken. And I just let him go, and he just slid to the floor, and I went off upstairs, and I said, yeah, you're not worth it. And I went upstairs, and I rang the doctor. And when the doctor actually came out. By this time, we'd managed to get my husband to vomit, so thrown up most of the stuff. And the doctor was saying things to me like, well, Mrs. Freeman, which was my married name, which I do not go by, do you really think that you want to do this? And I said, what do you mean, want to do this? And he said, well, you know, this going to the Gulf. He said, maybe you should just not go. He says, perhaps you should just stay and make your marriage work. And I literally just lost my temper with him. I said, look, I said, I've tried to make my marriage work for nearly 20 years. I said, I have done everything that this man wanted. I have set aside my own wants and needs and thoughts. I've looked after my kids. I have done everything that everybody ever wanted. And now the military, who have looked after me financially for the last 9 years, are asking me to give something back. I said, and I cannot, in all honesty, tell them that I can't go to war because my ex-husband is having a tantrum. I said, I cannot do that. I said, in any case, I said, what do you think they're going to do? I said, they will send the military police after me. I said, well, the local police, at the very least, I said, if I don't go back to camp. I said, you just can't do that. I said, it would be out, absent without leave. I said, it's a chargeable offence during wartime. And he said, I understand. He said, no, I wish you luck. And my ex-husband, of course, by this time, he had recovered. He'd thrown up, he was recovering. And I left him in the bed and I went to sleep. The boys had gone to bed and I went to sleep on the settee. And I was absolutely exhausted. And the next morning, when he was fine, he was bright, cheerful, chirpy, do you want a cup of tea and everything? And I looked like absolute death. And he said to me, maybe you ought to go and lie down on the bed. And I thought, yes, perhaps I need to. So I got undressed, got in the bed, and I slept. And I think for the first time since childhood, I actually wet the bed. Out of sheer stress, exhaustion, worry. And I don't mind saying that because it kind of gives people an idea of how I was feeling at the time. And the next day, my ex-husband decided that it would be very nice to imprison me in the house so that I couldn't go away. So that's what he did. He tried to lock me in, and my son's friends, who thought it was absolutely hysterical, broke me out. They picked the lock from outside and broke me out. And they took me to the station. I had no money. All I had was my return tickets. I had no money. I had a few sandwiches to pay for the Christmas turkey. And I stood on Washington Newtown bus station, and the rain was pouring down. And my son was there with three of his villainous friends who spent most of their time breaking in and out of shops because they weren't exactly, but they were like young hoodlums. But I said goodbye to my kids on that station with the rain coming down. And one of these young lads who had a terrible reputation came up to me and put his hand out and he said, goodbye, Mrs. Freeman. He said, come back safely. And I just literally just felt the tears, the literal tears, just, you know, that huge lump in my throat, the tears were just falling down. Because, you know, I couldn't get that from a man that I'd spent 20 years with, and yet this young tearaway had said, come back safely, you know. And the last thing I saw of my kids was through a rain-washed window in the back of a bus. And I cried all the way from Newcastle Station, all the way from Newcastle Central Station, down to Waterloo. And I didn't even see the people sat around me, but I was kind of aware of a lot of sympathetic glances. And when I, of course, got down to Brookwood, because I could get as far as Brookwood, I didn't have any money to get a cab, and of course it was late at night, no bus service. And there were a group of Welsh Guardsmen who were coming back off leave and were going back into camp. And I was asking the lady in the taxi place at Brookwood Station, do you think, look, I'll give you my rank, I'll give you my service number, I'll tell you, you know, this is where I am. I'm in the mess at Blackdown Barracks, and if you could just get one of your guys to take me, I promise you, you will get the taxi fare. And this young guardsman came up and he said, because I've come down, but I said, I've got to get back to camp because I'm due to go out to the Gulf. And one of the guardsmen overheard me and he came and he said, listen, he says, we'll pay your taxi fare. And they paid my taxi fare back to the mess. And that was New Year's Eve. And when I got back, they were preparing. They're living in the pads. The people in the married quarters were planning a New Year's Eve party when I got back, which of course I was not really in much of a mood for. And another thing that ironically happened, literally just the day before, the day before I actually left for Saudi, I received a letter from the University of London because I'd applied for various courses, university courses, and I received a letter asking me if I could attend for an interview the end of January, and I didn't have any paper, and I wrote on a tiny little scrappy piece of paper, which I posted off to them very quickly, that I was very sorry that I could not attend, that I really wanted to be kept on their list for a course, but that I was a soldier and that I am literally due to fly out to the Persian Gulf.